Nakula versus UGS, 063386. Is that Ms. Ms. or Mrs. Brown? Ms. All right.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Christy Brown, and I represent Mitch Nakula and Tooling Systems International. I'm not sure if some of the jurisdictional issues have been resolved by the consolidation, so if I'm addressing issues that have been resolved, please let me know. The initial issue that I want to address is whether a final judgment was entered in this case and whether that impacts the timeliness of the plaintiff's appeal. The
so
order.
You're going to then deal with that minute order entry.
Yes, Your Honor.
That was listed, you know, and why that entry doesn't serve as a final judgment here, making TSI's notice of appeal untimely. That's that minute order that says civil case terminated.
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. When I take a look at that minute order, it doesn't do what a final Rule 58 judgment order is supposed to do. It incorporates another document, so I don't think it really technically is a Rule 58 judgment. The judge's opinion did resolve all of the claims in the case because the motions on the active state doctrine did address all of the claims that had been raised. I'm not sure how that impacts the validity of the appeal. The notice of appeal can be filed if there is no Rule 58 judgment. After 150 days, a notice of appeal can still be filed. And although the plaintiffs didn't wait 150 days to file a notice of appeal, under Federal Appellate Procedure 4A2, a notice of appeal that's filed after an order disposing of the case but before a judgment is entered is treated as though filed in a timely manner as of the date that the judgment was entered. So I would argue that the second notice of appeal is still timely because it would be treated as though it were filed 150 days after Judge Gettleman dismissed the claims. And it would be a timely notice of appeal because the Rule 58 judgment really was not entered in this case. I also want to just talk about the adequacy of the two notices of appeal. As plaintiff's position that the first notice of appeal was adequate to advise opposing counsel and the court of an appeal on behalf of both parties, a corporation clearly can file a pro se notice of appeal under the case law. The corporation can't proceed to argument or to briefing without an attorney, but it can file a notice of appeal. Designating the wrong court, the Eighth Circuit versus this court, is not fatal to an appeal. It was clear to all the parties in the court. The district court forwarded the information to the Seventh Circuit. There was no confusion there. And also the failure to name Tool Systems in the body of the document is not fatal to this notice of appeal. Tool Systems was named in the caption. The notice of appeal that was filed pro se used an et al. Designation for all of the plaintiffs to include all of the plaintiffs in the notice of appeal. So I think the errors that were in the original notice of appeal are not fatal. I don't think it was misleading to the appellees as to what was being appealed or who was filing the appeal. And with respect to the second notice of appeal, there was some confusion here. The counsel who filed this intended it as a correction, to correct the errors in the original notice of appeal that was filed pro se. But when it got to the clerk's office, the clerk interpreted it as a second notice of appeal. I think if you look at it as purely a correction of the notice of appeal, instead of opening up a whole separate action, which was not counsel's intent, it simply corrects some technical defects in the notice of appeal and resolves those issues.
Before you get to your other arguments, I just have a question relating to the merits. Were the breach of contract issues that you attempt to raise in this suit in federal court, were those adjudicated by the Polish civil court?
No, Your Honor. There are two different contracts here. There was a licensing agreement. The licensing agreement was ultimately assigned to Alucon. That assignment was part of an oral contract entered into between Mr. Nakula and the defendants. The licensing agreement itself predated Alucon's involvement. It had been obtained by Mr. Haas, and it was assigned to Alucon. The lawsuit in Poland dealt with, under this licensing agreement, did you pay your licensing fees? And that was really the only issue that was resolved. Although, with all due respect, Your Honor, most of that is not in this record. This was a motion to dismiss on the basis of the pleadings, and no discovery was taken. It wasn't really gotten into what happened in Poland. The contract that we're suing on in this case is the contract entered into between Mr. Nakula and TSI and the defendants. And that contract was, if we agree to accept the assignment of the licensing agreement and go forward with the licensing agreement, you will withdraw your criminal complaint, stop pursuing the criminal action, do everything you can to terminate that action, and you'll continue to give us, as opposed to Mr. Haas, the updates to the software.
How is that not void as against public policy?
It's not void as against public policy because it was the plaintiff's position all along that the criminal complaint never should have been taken out, that they had a legitimate license.
But a contract to interfere with an ongoing criminal prosecution.
Your Honor, I don't think it was a contract to interfere.
Well, not interfere, but to cause it to cease. I mean, that's not the private party's prerogative. The private party does not have the right to contract for that.
Certainly, the defendants would have been obligated to continue to cooperate if the criminal proceeding had requested their cooperation.
So it was a contract to refuse to cooperate with governmental authorities?
No,
that's my point.
No, Your Honor, absolutely not. It was a contract to withdraw your complaint. This was a business dispute where the defendants came in to the criminal authorities and said, look, they're improperly using our software. And the plaintiff's position all along is, no, we weren't improperly using software. We had a license from the United States company. That licensing agreement included using the license in Poland for this joint venture. There was no improper use of the license. So all it was saying was, look, if we resolve your concerns about the license by officially assigning it, then you're going to withdraw your criminal complaint because there is no more concern. There is no more problem. We're resolving it. We'll take the assignment. We'll take on the responsibilities of the licensing agreement.
Was the Polish criminal case a prosecution for theft?
It was a prosecution for improperly using that license. So it was an intangible that was being taken. So, it's no different than a criminal prosecution here. If a complaining business came in and said, you know, they're stealing our intellectual property, but then later came in and said, you know what, we've resolved it, we don't want to pursue this complaint anymore, the complaint would go away. It's that simple. And it's not illegal to contract for that, to say, look, if we resolve your concerns with regard to this licensing agreement, then you stop pursuing the criminal complaint. And that's all the contract was for, and to essentially organize the business. There ended up being somewhat of a disconnect between the U.S. company and the Polish company, and this agreement was intended to resolve that. The defendants violated the agreement. The defendants fraudulently induced the agreement. 3 months after the agreement, they still went forward with the criminal complaint. They still, on their part, pursued the criminal action. I'd like to save the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you. Mr. Frommel?
Good morning. May it please the Court, Jonathan Frommel on behalf of the defendants appellees in this litigation. I'd like to start where counsel left off in terms of whether there's one contract or two contracts. If you look plainly at the face of the First Amendment complaint, we're talking about one contract here, and as counsel indicated, she's talking about a licensing agreement that was part of an oral agreement. That, to me, by definition, is one contract. And the terms of that contract is a contract between the Polish corporation Alucon, where Alucon agreed to accept maintenance and support for software in return for appellee's agreement to, alleged agreement to not proceed or to do everything in its power to stop the Polish criminal proceedings and to transfer a license that had been held by an American company to the Polish company. One contract at issue here, and that contract was decided by the Polish civil courts. As counsel alleged in both the First Amendment complaint and at argument, the courts did decide in Poland the specific issue of, was there a breach of that contract? Alucon wasn't paying maintenance fees, allegedly, and UGS Poland brought a civil litigation in Poland to resolve that issue. That issue was resolved in favor of UGS Poland, and there shouldn't be any reexamination or modification of that decision in this court. What counsel is asking this court and asked below at the district court level to do is to basically take away or reverse the decision of the Polish civil courts with respect to that contract claim.
That was an agreement between Alucon and UGS Poland, right?
That's correct,
and
Your Honor.
Which raises another issue here about the ability of Mr. Nakula to and Tooling Systems International to assert any rights under that contract. They were not a party to that contract.
I agree with you, Your Honor, as well as whether they have that right. I don't believe they have that right. That issue wasn't briefed down below, but I don't believe they have that right. Even if they did have that right, to exercise that right, they necessarily and impermissibly would have to reverse, reexamine, modify the actions taken by the Polish civil courts.
And Mr. Nakula, as the sole shareholder, can't assert the rights of the corporation. The corporation has to assert its own rights.
That's correct, Your Honor.
But he's the plaintiff in his personal capacity here.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Together with TIS.
And I think that's an issue that Judge Gettleman raised down below as well. He was very concerned about that issue as well, of whether there truly is standing for Mr. Nakula to bring these claims. We focused our argument and our briefing on the active state doctrine because we believe, regardless of how that issue is resolved, and I agree, I believe that issue should be resolved in favor of appellees, but regardless of how that issue is resolved, the active state doctrine would bar the breach of contract claim in any event.
What was the subject matter of the criminal prosecution in Poland? Was it a theft?
My understanding is that it was an intellectual property theft claim.
Go ahead. Are you done?
And the basic gist of the complaint, and you can see it from some of the facts alleged in the First Amendment complaint, is that the Polish company Alucon was using software, had loaded software onto its computers, but the license for that software resided in the United States with Electrode, an American company. So the criminal action was brought as a result of, I guess, allegedly the improper use of the license.
Can you tell me how this dispute between two private parties has any bearing on the foreign relations between Poland and the United States? I mean, isn't that the primary concern of the active state doctrine?
Absolutely it is, Your Honor, and it has a direct bearing on the relationship because necessarily, if you ticked through all four claims that I was able to ascertain from the First Amendment complaint, all four potential causes of action here, each and every one of those causes of action would require this court or the district court to overturn a civil judgment entered by the courts in Poland.
Well, aren't foreign court judgments usually not considered acts of state? And when we look at the restatement of foreign law, it explicitly says that they usually are not. Do you have any contrary authority?
Well, Your Honor, it's my understanding from the Farman case that we cited, the Iranian case where the consulting fees had not been paid as a result of the Iranian council, I believe it was a court entity in Iran, had disbanded or had taken over the entity. It's my understanding that as a result, that is at least one example where a foreign council or foreign court did, in fact, take action, and the court looked at that and said that was the act of a sovereign state.
You cited that in your brief, but isn't that different from our situation here?
It's different in the extent
that... And distinguishable.
Well, it's different, Your Honor, to the extent that in the Farman case, there was, in fact, an actual taking by the Iranian council, Iranian court.
Right.
I would suggest, Your Honor, that the Polish civil courts in this case have also exercised a taking by entering a judgment against the plaintiffs and by taking their property, their dollars, their business equipment, as was alleged in the First Amendment complaint.
But not for the state. Not as in the Iranian situation, but for your client.
That's correct, Your Honor. That's correct. And it can be distinguished in that fashion, but I would still suggest that this is, again, a decision that has been entered and decided by the Polish civil courts down below.
Well, why would this suit necessarily require a U.S. court to find that the Polish authorities improperly seized the computers? The tort of abusive process doesn't require showing that the authorities acted improperly, just that a party misused the legal system for ulterior purposes.
Well, with respect to the abusive process claim, counsel has suggested and argued in its brief that it's not challenging the Polish seizure. It's not claiming that it was damaged necessarily as a result of that seizure. What counsel is claiming in its initial brief, it's on pages 10 and 11 of its brief, is that not that it was harmed as a result of the initial seizure by the Polish authorities, but instead that it is alleging that if UGS and UGS Poland had fulfilled its contractual obligations and stopped pursuing the criminal complaint against Alucon, Alucon's property would not have been lost. So this, again, the abusive prosecution claim, again ties into the Polish civil courts and the Polish civil courts' decision affirming the contract between the parties. Now, with respect to the tortious interference claim and the fraudulent inducement claim that are also at issue here, we had heard earlier in this court the issue of fraudulent inducement of a contract that eventually was entered into. In this situation, we again have the Polish courts, civil courts, have resolved the issue of whether this was a legitimate contract, have determined that the contract, have determined the contract in favor of the defendants in this litigation to indicate that there was some type of fraudulent inducement, that the contract itself is not legitimate, that it was not a valid contract because of some fraud, would necessarily have to overturn and reverse the ruling of the Polish civil authorities in deciding that the contract was legitimate, that Alucon had breached that contract, and in awarding UGS Poland damages, including monetary damages, and I believe the seizure of some additional assets of the Polish company Alucon.
Yeah, we discussed a little early on some jurisdictional issues, but I want you to answer this specific question. Do you have any authority that a notice of appeal filed by a non-lawyer, in this instance the plaintiff, on behalf of the corporation is ineffective? I understand generally only lawyers can represent corporations, but you don't have any authority.
No, Your Honor. The specific issue with respect to the pro se notice of appeal was that it did not give clear evidence of TSI's intent to appeal. The initial notice of appeal listed Mr. Nakula in the body as the sole appellant. It referenced petitioners singularly as opposed to plural, and it referenced his specific rights as opposed to their rights or rights in plural. So our suggestion is that if Judge Gettleman's order was an appropriate judgment under Rule 58, then this court does not have jurisdiction with respect to TSI because there was no manifest clear intent of TSI to appeal. Right. So because the active state doctrine applies, I respectfully request that you affirm Judge Gettleman's order. Thank you.
How much time does she have? 1 minute, Ms. Brown?
Thank you, Your Honor. On the jurisdictional issue, I would also just point out that Federal Rule of Appellate Procedure 4A3, once a notice of appeal has been filed on behalf of one party in a litigation, allows any other party in the litigation to file their notice of appeal within 14 days, and the second notice of appeal was filed within that time period. With regard to the criminal prosecution, as Your Honor pointed out, we are not claiming that the Polish government did something improper here. We're not challenging their acts. We're challenging the acts of the defendants in maliciously prosecuting this claim when they knew or should have known that there was no claim to prosecute.
Well, you're seeking recovery for the improper seizure of the computers.
We're seeking recovery for the inability of our client to get the property back because of the malicious prosecution.
Right.
If it weren't for the acts of the defendants, those computers would have been returned. The case would have been dismissed. But they refused to go in and dismiss it as they had agreed to do.
Doesn't that necessarily go to the subject matter of the criminal prosecution in Poland?
I don't believe it does, Your Honor. I believe that if the complaint had been withdrawn, the computers would have been returned. And we're also not claiming a breach of the licensing agreement. We're claiming a breach of this oral contract to stop pursuing the criminal action and to allow the transfer of the license.
All right. Thank you, counsel, both for fine arguments. We will take them under advisement.